Alors, j'ai un peu abusé de ma position d'organisateur et on va passer la parole à Monsieur McFerron qui va nous présenter l'aspect comportemental donc de ces Homo sapiens anciens et puis on prendra des questions après.
Good morning. At first, I must apologize. I am not going to subject you to my American French. Instead, I'm going to speak in English, and I hope I can speak in a way that you can understand me along with my slides. So I'm going to transition us from some of the earlier material that we heard of this morning to what we're going to hear this afternoon, which is some of the developments in the later Middle Stone Age. And to do that, I want to emphasize the context, which is in this African context, this long period from around 2.6 million years ago, when we have the first stone tools, the old one, to the Middle Stone Age, the period that we're interested in for this presentation, around 300,000 years ago. And particularly, I want to emphasize this long period that came before, the Acheulean, where they manufactured, it's characterized by these hand axes that we heard mention of previously, these large, heavy-duty tools that are made primarily by shaping a stone into a particular form, sometimes on a large flake and sometimes on a cobble. And the transition that occurred with the Middle Stone Age is this switch to where you're shaping the stone, but not to make a tool itself, but to remove a flake that then becomes a tool. And the technology that defines the Middle Stone Age and that allows us to identify this transition in particular is this technology, Levallois, obviously first defined here in the region of Paris. And with those flakes, you can then make things that look like this. You can make these small points. And we think, we have evidence in various places, that these points may have been hafted and served as projectiles and allowed hominins to hunt animals more effectively. In particular, if you can throw a stone, a projectile with a sharp stone on it, you can kill an animal from further away. It's safer for you. It's a more effective hunting technique. It was probably an important transition from the Acheulean to the Middle Stone Age that was based around this technology. By the end of the Middle Stone Age, let's say after 125,000 years ago to about 50,000 years ago, we see the development of all sorts of other aspects of the material record, of the archaeology. We see not only the stone tools, but we see various forms, and those forms vary by region. So you don't have the same stone tools in North Africa that you have in South Africa. You see ornaments. You see the use of shells as beads in both in North Africa and in South Africa. You see experimentation with ochre. You see decoration of ostrich eggshell. And you see abundance of bone tools. All these things are new in the later Middle Stone Age, okay? And as I said, we see these things in North Africa as well. I think we're going to hear more about this afternoon, but in particular, this culture we call the Aterian, which characterizes the late Middle Stone Age of North Africa and is distinctive for these points, these tanged points and tanged artifacts that you find, and again, the use of shells and bone tools and so forth, right? So this diverse material culture that archaeologists call modern human culture and that is really indistinguishable from things that are found later in Africa and that certainly characterize us, later Homo sapiens, right? So we speak about the modern biology, but we also speak about modern human culture. And it's in this time period of the Middle Stone Age in Africa that we have the origins of this phenomenon. And we know, too, that at the end of the Middle Stone Age, probably around 45,000 years ago, These individuals, these biologically and behaviorally modern humans, then left the region of Africa and Southwest Asia and expanded out through the rest of the world, as Jean-Jacques just talked to us about, and replaced all of the other archaic populations, which implies that they had a biology and a culture, a behavior, a set of behaviors that was very effective, that was a very good adaptation that could be expanded throughout the world and could outcompete all of these other archaic populations that had been there for hundreds of thousands of years. And in a very short time, those populations disappeared. So that makes the Middle Stone Age really an important, critical time period to understand who we are and how we came about. The problem is that, as has been mentioned many times this morning, the history of research in various parts of the world is uneven, and the history of research in Africa is uneven, and for various reasons having to do with site preservation and history of archaeology, we don't have so many sites from this early Middle Stone Age period in Africa. So this map is from 2006, and it's changed a little. There's a few more sites on here. But this covers a period from roughly 300,000 to 128,000. And I would guess you could find this many sites from the metro in Paris. You could just take the metro to this many sites from this same time period, roughly, right, for all of Africa, okay? So it's a very challenging data set. Now, you notice that in Northwest Africa, we have one site, Jebel Irhoud, and a date attached to it of 130,000 to 186,000, which was correct, more or less, in 2006 when this map was made. So what I'm going to talk to you about now is our effort to go back to this site and reinvestigate this important early Middle Stone Age site and to bring new light on the date and the archaeology of the site. So as Jean-Jacques just said, it's located in Morocco, somewhat between Marrakesh and the coast, in an environment that looks like this today. The Jebel itself is this feature right here. It's a prominent feature on the landscape. It's easy to see from far away. It dominates the landscape. And as we saw a moment ago, this is what it looks like from the Jebel, from the site. And on a clear day, you can see back to the Atlas Mountains. And as Jean-Jacques said, this is give you some idea of what it looks like during a greener part of time, a part of the year. Now, the Jebel has a number of caves in it. It has a lot of karstic features. It's like a Swiss cheese. Underneath, it just has all these complex systems of cavities. And some of these have now been exposed to the surface. I'm showing you a couple here. And they, as Jean-Jacques mentioned, it's been subject to mining activities over the last decades for barite. Here's what, just a few tens of meters away, here's our cavity, Jebel Irhoud, that we're interested in, the particular location that gives the name. And as Jean-Jacques said, that we have to imagine that at one time, this as well was covered. At the time that hominins were coming, it was exposed, it was open, you could go in, but at the same time, it would have been covered. And you can see the older cavity here and here, and all of this then that looks fresh has been removed. And the sediments that we excavated are right here. To give you some idea, when Anushi was drawn to the site and when the initial hominin material was discovered, the site looked something like this. It still had its roof. They had constructed a small train track to carry the sediments out of the cave and identified two layers. And here in this schematic, noting the location of the first two hominin fossils that came out, the two skulls. Then the next work that was done at the site, the first sort of real systematic archaeology, was conducted in 1967 and 1969 for a few weeks over those years. By then, the roof had been removed, and the remaining deposits were here along the wall. And you can see the excavations happening here. That work, unfortunately, was not published right away, but then Jean-Jacques and colleagues in 1987 put together a description of another one of the human remains, Erhud IV, a humerus, that was found in layer 18 in this sequence. And with that, Jacques Tixier described the archaeology and portrayed an assemblage dominated by Lavaux, that technology I told you about, and especially with lots of scrapers and retouched elements, stone retouched tools, and especially lots of pointed elements. And the Middle Stone Age is characterized by points. And indeed, Jebel Erhud had a high percentage of points. At the time, in 1980s, when we talk about the archaeology of Jebel Erhud in North Africa, we used European terms. And so it was called Mousterian at the time. And Mousterian, you probably know, is the industry of Neanderthals at the same time period. And indeed, it does look just like a Mousterian industry. I also, some of you may know from a presentation I did a year ago here, I also excavate Mousterian sites. I know Mousterian stone tools, and the stone tools from Jebel Erhud look just like Mousterian, with an emphasis on retouch tools and Lavaux. There were two other studies done of the stone tools from Jebel Erhud. There was one in 1970 based on 400 lithics coming from Anushi's work at the site, and the same conclusion was reached, that it's a Lavaux Mousterian rich in scrapers. And then another study in 1995 with a much larger sample of 1,600 artifacts, again, came to the exact same conclusion, that it's characterized by these retouched points. At the time when we began our project, the date of the site was known from some work, especially by Rainer Grun, who did a technique called electrospin residence on some teeth coming from above the human remains from Tixier's excavation, and gave a date that was roughly between 200 and 100,000 years old, right? So a fairly large air range on that date. And then, as part of work in Jean-Jacques' department at Max Planck, a new effort, again by Rainer Grun, was made to date the hominin, one of the hominins, and that same age range was tightened up, right? So we're still in that same ballpark, but with a smaller air on the age. And that's what we knew about Jebel Erhud when we began our project then in 2004. Here's a photo of what the site looked like when Jean-Jacques, Abdelwahed Benser, Jean-Paul Renal, and several others of us came and started cleaning the site and trying to figure out what we would do. And what we identified is a block of sediments that remain from Tixier's excavations in 1969. And if I just zoom in on that, it looked like this. And unfortunately, quite a bit had been lost over the years to erosion, but there remained a sample of the original sequence that we could still excavate. And so we set up scaffolding and started at the top, as one does, and worked our way through layers that had no archaeology, that were characterized by hyena use of the site, down into the lower layers where the archaeology begins. At the very base of the sequence, resting on this rock, this huge boulder that helped, I think, preserve the sediments that remained. And the human remains that Jean-Jacques just reported come mostly from here, and the archaeology comes from throughout these bottom layers here. Now, we were lucky, you saw this figure in the last presentation, we were lucky in several ways at Jebel Erhud. One of them was finding so many human fossils, all the points in red. That was lucky. Not every site has that many human fossils. We were very fortunate to find new human fossils from our excavations so that we could date them. And then the second thing we were lucky about is that at the site, as was mentioned this morning, there was the use of fire, and that fire heated those flints in the sediment, and that allowed us to apply this technique called thermoluminescence and then provide an age for these deposits. We had a lot of flints that were heated, so we could date a lot of them. In fact, we gave a very large portion of our collection to Daniel Richter, who then produced a number of dates. And as Jean-Jacques said, when you take in all the air bars and everything, it's around 300,000 years old. So that changed our view of Jebel Irhoud. It took it from sort of the later part of the early Middle Stone Age to the very beginning of the Middle Stone Age, and one of the oldest sites then in Africa from the Middle Stone Age. Our stone tools confirmed what others had said about the assemblage. Again, it's Lavawa, and again, it's an emphasis on points, which is so characteristic of the Middle Stone Age. Most of it is on flint, but then there is a small percentage of the lithics that are made on other kinds of materials, especially silicified limestone. I draw your attention to pieces like this, these finely made points that are sort of off axis, some more here, and so forth, that are very characteristic of this assemblage. If we just look at, for some of the archaeologists in the audience, some of the technical numbers on this assemblage to prove that it's Middle Stone Age, and which is one of the things that we had to do, actually. We see that there are a great number, the way they prepared their platforms is there's a lot of faceting of the platforms, which means they're preparing those cores before they strike off the flake, which is characteristic of this time period, and we have a strong percentage of Lavawa flakes. If we look at the tool types that we have represented, again, as I've said several times now, it's a dominance on these points. If we're in southwest France, we call them scrapers, and we call them convergent scrapers and déjeté scrapers, like these terms here. If we're in Africa, then we call them points, okay? But it's retouching the two edges into a pointed form. There's a couple other things that I want to draw your attention to. One, there's virtually no cores in the site, and there's very little debris. These are the waste flakes that come from making stone tools. What we find is that, in fact, over half of the lithics that we find are made on flint, and most of the tools are made on flint. We find very few cores, and very few of the cores are made on flint, right? And we find a large percentage of retouched tools. I know this for you, this number has no context, but normally most of a stone tool assemblage is flakes, just the debris from making stone tools, and you have very few retouched tools. At Jebel Irhoud, it's a very strange situation that we have one tool for every three flakes, right? That's not normal at all. And we also have very, very, very little cortex. Cortex is the part of it's the outside of the stone, right? And most of the stone tools that were thrown away at Jebel Irhoud don't retain any of this. Now, what does that mean? Why am I emphasizing that? It's because this taken together indicates a very specialized site function. This is not a kind of living site where people are bringing in nodules of material and working them and spending a lot of time. This sort of assemblage suggests that people are bringing in already finished stone tools, probably hunting weapons. They're doing some maintenance of those things, but very little maintenance of those tools, and then they're leaving. And we know from raw material surveys done by Jean-Paul Renal and his student Paul Fernandez, in fact, they've been able to identify the source of this flint, and it comes from about 20 or 30 kilometers away. So what that allows us to do is paint this picture of these early Homo sapiens moving around this landscape, at times visiting places where they had flint and taking advantage of that to make their stone tools, their hunting weapons, and so forth, then passing through a place like Jebel Irhoud, probably as a short hunting encampment, right, as they're passing through, retooling some of their stone tools, and then moving on. What were they hunting? We know from the fauna that the fauna is dominated by gazelle, and we know from the study of the cut marks on the fauna that it looks as fact that it was humans that were bringing the gazelle into the site. There is also evidence of carnivores in the site. We have coprolites and we have bones that were modified by carnivores, but it's a low level. It's the dominant signature is humans bringing these gazelles into the site and butchering them. We also, as was mentioned, have evidence of fire. And if you were here last year and heard me speak, you know that fire is not as, you don't find as much evidence of fire as you might imagine. But at Jebel Irhoud at 300,000, if we zoom in, we see these small bands of burnt material, of charcoal. And then what we do is the geologist, Jean-Paul, and his students take samples, they take blocks of the sediment, look at them under a microscope, and then it can identify the burnt particles, the charcoal and so forth that's in these things and confirm that, in fact, there is fire. Another way we can look at that is by looking at the percentage of heated lithics and heated bones in the sediment. And again, you don't have comparison, but these numbers are very, very high. This is a heavy, strong use of fire at Jebel Irhoud. So to summarize Jebel Irhoud, we have a Middle Stone Age site that's 300,000 years old now, much older than previously thought. It has lots of tools, and these tools are dominated by scrapers and points. And we have a lot of evidence that the lithics were made off-site and brought to the site. And we think they were hunting gazelle using fire, and we know that they left lots of skeletons behind, okay? So it's a very unusual site in that regard. If we pull back and we try to place Jebel Irhoud into the context of Africa, it's on the one hand, we have points of comparison, but at the other hand, it is challenging. There are few. There is another site in the northern part of Morocco, Benzu Rock Shelter, which dates to about 250,000 years ago, where you also find a Middle Stone Age with Lavawa and with points that seems to be similar. If we switch entirely and we go to East Africa, recently Allison Brooks and colleagues published a series of papers on the very important site of Ologosale, which is known more for its older materials, for its Acheulean, but they also reported now a rich Middle Stone Age that dates roughly to the same time period as Jebel Irhoud and has the same sorts of lithics. This time, a lot of them made out of obsidian that was likewise transported long distances into the site. And they show evidence of the use of ochre, which is very interesting because that would be unusual in this early time period. If we go to South Africa, we have a couple sites we can talk about. Floresbad, which Jean-Jacques mentioned previously, has around the same age, 265, 275,000 years ago, a stone tool industry that some have identified as Middle Stone Age. It's not very typical, and it's a site that needs to be reinvestigated and a little bit better published to understand these early stone tool industries. But we also have another site in South Africa, Katupan, which has a layer that's actually older than the one we're talking about. It's more like 400,000 or older, and it shows this systematic production of Lavawa points and elongated things that have been called blades. So very similar in a way to Jebel Irhoud. The point being that at this time period, at 300,000 years ago, we have this expansion, we have the presence of the Middle Stone Age across all of Africa. Now, why is that? This was touched on previously, but we have to consider that Morocco was part of Africa at various times. The Sahara was not the barrier that it is today. And we have these greening, what are called Green Sahara events, when the Sahara would have been more integrated into Africa, and it would have been an environment that hominins could have entered into, could have pursued game, and could have moved across North Africa. I think we're going to hear more about this later, but we have a very warm event around 300,000 years ago, and that would have been, in all likelihood, a Green Sahara event, and that corresponds nicely with this archaeology that we're finding in East Africa, South Africa, and now in Morocco. And as mentioned previously, we see that the fauna during this time period are similar between East Africa and North Africa, and if the fauna were moving around, likely the people were moving around too after that fauna. I think I'm going to skip this because I'm running out of time, but the point is that that places like Jebel Irhoud were integrated into this dry grassland that fits with the fauna that we're finding as well. So I also wanted to note that our conference is about North Africa, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that at this same time period, MIS-9, around 300,000 years ago, we also find the same technologies outside of Africa. So not only do we have evidence of this dispersal of the Middle Stone Age across Africa, but we have the same technology occurring at more or less the same time period outside of Africa. And this phenomenon is still not well explained, how you would have had this co-occurring at roughly the same time period. For some reason, even though they made this map in 2019, they left off a couple important sites here in our region, but I include the map anyway. So just in summary, the Middle Stone Age is across Africa by 300,000 years ago, and witnessed during this important time period from 300,000 years ago to 50,000 years ago, what we might call non-linear change. And what I mean by that is that from the previous time period, from 2.5 million years ago up until this point, it's very hard to see much change, right? There's some advances we can point to, but it's a pretty steady continuation of the same material culture, right? A very successful adaptation with hand axes. Then there's this switch to making flakes and making points, and within a very short time period, you have this rapid accumulation of all sorts of different technologies that by the late Middle Stone Age, we call modern human culture. But the problem is that understanding the processes that led to that is hampered by the fact that this database is still really small for this early time period. So it's very difficult to understand what sorts of processes led to this development during the Middle Stone Age. And that's why I emphasize, too, a site like Jebel Irhoud. We can start to talk about what they were doing there, but it has a very specific site function. It's a very peculiar site. And some of these other sites that I mentioned, Floresbad and Katupan, likewise, are single data points that are supposed to represent whole regions. And it's not enough for us to build an idea of the variability that we were seeing there and be able to test the models that Jean-Jacques was talking about the development of regionalization in Africa during this time period. Thank you.